Blog Talk Radio. I hate that when the audio goes. Especially when I'm on a roll. When I'm engaged in a great monologue, anyone one that sounds great to me. Blog Talk Radio has been acting up. This has been doing some weird things. I need to check with tech support tomorrow. Their comments have been coming up out over the air, which in the past they were just set up for me. Right now it kicked me out. My Skype disconnected. And it said that I want to end my episode. I didn't realize that the Skype had disconnected. Anyway, so what I was talking about is the riots have started. There's a certain number of riots. They're not quite as bad as they were. But I've heard people talk about what a racist jury this was in the Trayvon Martin case. And I think it's important. When someone says racist jury, what do they mean? When we talk about racism, what does that mean? When it comes down to the jury system, and in this case in particular, if you're going to say it's racist jury, would it have been a racist jury if the same people had been picked and they'd come up with a guilty verdict against George Zimmerman for either manslaughter or second-degree murder? I ask that question very seriously. Is the outcome of the jury's decision, the outcome of the jury verdict, what determines whether someone's racist or not? And if the jury doesn't come up with a decision you like in a particular case or I like in a particular case, that makes them somehow racist, prejudiced, whatever you want to call it. You don't even need to enter race into it. I've kind of kicked this around in my mind over the day. What would have happened if this had never hit the news media other than the bare basics, a neighborhood watchman, I'm trying to think of a way to say this, was following someone he suspected of casing the neighborhood, a fight ensued, and one person was shot. And nothing came out until the trial came up. And you never knew the race, age, or any of that stuff of the person. You knew their basic physical characteristics. You knew what happened to them. Would it still be the same? I think it's really important. If we're really, and what I'd said before Blog Talk Radio rudely kicked me out, and I got no audio, if we can't count on the jury, why do away with the legal system? Do away with the jury system? There's something very amiss, something very wrong, talking about it being a racist jury without any qualifications. I've been talking a little bit about racism. It's one of those things that you don't go there. A lot of hosts do. I've stayed away from it from an interesting standpoint. I think it's a very important thing to be discussed. By the same token, unless you can keep cool heads and cooler heads prevail, what you wind up with is not a productive conversation, but yelling and screaming back and forth that really gives no clarity on the issue. What does it mean to be racist? What is racism? You really need to get down to that. How is the jury racist? Like I said, if in fact it had been otherwise, it had come back with a guilty verdict on George Zimmerman, would people have said, that was a great jury. They came up with the right decision. I'm glad we got a not non-racist jury. Do we really believe that people go into the jury room and carry that much baggage with them? If so, and if that's the case, maybe we need to rethink everything we do about our laws. Maybe it just needs to be up for public vote on the internet. Albeit I saw a survey the other day on the internet that said 74% of the population did not think the case was proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And when it doesn't turn out the way we want, do we riot? I mean, if you have someone that's a small business person, like people in Oakland, and you're torching their businesses, throwing bricks and rocks through the windows, two things. How does that help Trayvon Martin, number one? And what gives you the right to go after someone in your own neighborhood that had nothing to do with the decision? There's something wrong with that society. Now, maybe we don't care about a civilized society. Maybe there is no such thing as civilized people. I mean, that's certainly something to talk about, something I'm amenable to consider. But what really is the case? You know, I've seen a lot of comments on this. I've had friends of mine on Facebook comment on it. You know, one person said that the decision literally made them sick. And I says, oh yeah, why is that? Because it didn't turn out the way you wished? What do you know about the case? Did you follow it? Do you know what the evidence was that was presented? All that kind of stuff. Are you saying, do you believe that women can't be trusted to be good jurors because it was an all-female jury? You know, someone posted this article today that was actually, I thought, pretty well written. It's a young lady. Her name is Maryam Khan Ansari. Don't know anything about her. Let's see what it says about her. I didn't bother to look that up. She looks. I won't give you her ethnic background. It doesn't really say here. This looks like it's going to Google Plus, in her circle of friends. Have her in my circle of friends. But she looks. She looks maybe Palestinian or something. I don't know. She says it's been hours since the jury in the George Zimmerman case reached its not guilty verdict, and already the questions have begun. Okay. Here are the five reasons why George Zimmerman was acquitted. Now, well, you tell me whether they're racist or not. He says, perhaps the greatest way to sum up why Zimmerman escaped conviction is that there was a reasonable doubt in legal terms. Reasonable doubt means that if there exists even a tiny shred of doubt on the defendant's guilt, he cannot be found guilty. Well, I don't think it's quite that stringent for reasonable doubt. But no doubt, you could have certain doubts, but that being said, it wasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Lack of eyewitness testimony, that probably had a tremendous amount to do with what the jury struggles with. Now, I keep hearing this, it was a racist jury. I absolutely hear it was my talking about Mickey Mouse, eh? I hear it was a racist jury, but was it racist because it was female? Really, I want to know. Let me go through a couple more. Lack of eyewitness testimony, Zimmerman's word against Martin's word, and without Martin being there to attest, it became very difficult for the prosecution to make its case beyond a reasonable doubt. It also became much easier for the defense to paint Trayvon Martin as a less sympathetic character. Well, I know that the victim, the one that was shot, was certainly not on trial, but you're sitting in the jury and you're given a set of instructions and you're told what second degree murder is and you're told what first degree manslaughter is, and in the legal system you're not supposed to be allowed to just make it up.
Yeah, let's talk about racism.
What about it? What is racism? Well,
you allowed me to be. I'm hearing my own voice. Why is that? I hate that.
I know. I don't know. But as soon as I you came up, I can hear kind of a hiss in the background.
I don't care about the hiss in the background. I'm hearing my own voice.
Well, it's not. I will mute me, and you tell me if your stuff goes. Oh, that was you. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that was good. So I'm not hearing myself now. So it's you. You're not using a headset.
Okay, we're both here.
Yeah, I didn't hear myself. Right? You muted yourself.
Okay, it's something to do with Skype. I can't hear myself echoing, but I hear a little.
Are
little
you
bit
using
of,
a headset?
Yes, I am.
How strange.
Yes.
Well, let's get through this because I don't really. Let's make the point here. Yesterday, I was accused of not liking black people nor women. By Jackie. Are you allowed that to stand?
Go ahead.
You have no excuse for that.
I haven't. I know exactly why I allowed it to stand. But that's okay. You know, you don't. Go ahead. Go ahead. You've got open mic.
Well, tell me why you allowed that to stand. Why did you mute me and allow that statement to stand unrefuted?
Because you opened up with an attack on Jackie in that conversation. You didn't.
So what?
Because you were not being civilized, and I just opted to mute you. Then the comment was made, and a lot of
you
comments.
Allowed it to stand.
I did not stand with it, though. I didn't say make any comment on it.
No, when you don't refute a comment, and you know as well as I do.
What?
You know as well as I do in a court of law that if you don't refute a statement, it stands.
It stands from that. Go on. So you were called a racist. Are you a racist or not?
No, we'll deal with that in a second. Why was I?
We'll deal with it now. You know, are you racist?
I have an entire. You know what? You got to do something about this. I can't listen to myself.
Yeah. Okay. I will go ahead and mute me. And when I want to cut in, if.
Well, I guess that'll work. Am I a racist? You bet your ass I am. Everybody's a racist. Anybody who tells me that they're not a racist. They're full of crap. But you allowed her to frame.
Okay, wait a second. You are a racist, and the accusation was not inaccurate.
I didn't tell you how I was a racist, did I? I just said everybody was a racist. Everybody has racist thoughts of one type or another.
To paint everybody with the same label that you classify yourself. So I'm listening. Go ahead.
But the question I want to ask you is, why did you come to her aid? This wasn't an arm wrestling match between me and her. I'm sure Tulio probably think that she would beat me in an arm wrestling match, but I don't really give a shit. But this was a match of wits, of minds. Why did you feel the need to come in and run defense for her?
Because I don't like it when someone comes on my show and immediately tries to box someone into a corner in the conversation.
Why? She does it all the time. Why do you allow her to do it and not me?
I allow you to do it plenty.
Why do you allow her to do it?
I allow you plenty hours on my show. As you say, you like to take over my show. My wife was yelling at me last night, don't let her take over your show. Listen, it's my show. I can do whatever I want with it. I give you more than adequate airtime to express your points of view and defend yourself.
Let's be clear about something. You give me more than adequate airtime because it's good for you.
I give you more than adequate airtime because I'm a benevolent soul.
No. Let's admit, let's be very clear. You give me more than adequate airtime because it's good for you.
No, I give you more than adequate airtime solely out of the benevolence of my heart. I do like
it's
you.
It's not out of benevolence. Well, yeah, that goes without saying, but it's not out of benevolence.
I think that people like to see if we're going to have some carnage. It goes back and forth. I do like you. I really do.
I know you think that
we have pretty good dialogue. And I give you more than your share of time, even amidst your insults, which, you know, run off my back like water off a duck's back.
I know that. But let's be honest and let's put it out on the table. Wait a minute. Let's put it out on the table that you do it out of pure selfishness because it makes you happy and it helps you. You don't do it to help me.
No. It's clearly in talk radio, I can opt to do monologues, which I'm perfectly capable of doing. I came to that conclusion many years ago. If you're not, someone's not willing to get behind a mic and talk for the full period of time that they're on, they shouldn't be in the business. Number one. Number two, on Blog Talk Radio, there is no requirement like on commercial radio to fill any time. If someone gets frustrated, I could throw up my hands in the air and say, oh, my God, I can't stand this, and hang, I don't need to do it anymore. So that's number one. But I know what I think all the time. It's always interesting to have someone else on there. And so, and I like your bright person. I know that you annoy a lot of people. I know a lot of people don't listen to you. If they really listened to what you said, they might not be quite as plugged in. That's my assessment.
I don't think I got that last statement.
I say that a lot of people make their judgments and evaluations about you because they don't always listen to you carefully, and they add to what you say. That's not exactly how I said it. So I would say that in some ways you're just a soul whose intention is good. Oh, Lord, please don't let you be misunderstood.
Yes, but you're still dancing around the original premise, and that is that it's pure selfishness on your part that you allot me all this airtime.
It isn't. I keep telling you it's not. I do it out of the benevolence of my heart for you, since you like to have the label of being the one that takes over everybody's show. I want to make you feel good.
Oh, babe, but somewhere deep down, that makes you happy. That
You're telling me I get something out of it?
Yes.
Huh? Is that more simply? You know, why are you dancing around the issue? Of course I get something out of it.
So it is pure selfishness.
No, that's a different issue. Pure selfishness,
well,
and getting
maybe,
something.
Maybe you're, and I'm thinking
are,
of a...
Are different things, but that's okay. Go
I'm
on.
Thinking of selfishness in the objectivist vein.
So there's in the subjectivist mode. You're thinking of selfishness as not being a bad thing, as opposed to many people. Instead of many people think, oh, he's selfish, that's a terrible thing. He shouldn't be selfish. When in reality, selfish people that really care about themselves really actually ultimately care about other people as well. Because if it's self-serving for me, it's going to be serving for you as well. That's very Ayn Randish, and I think she's got some very good stuff to say on that. In fact, let me pull that up. I'll play her comment on selfishness, because I don't know if a lot of people have heard that. But keep going while I'm pulling it up.
Well, I'd be interested in hearing that as well. Now, remember, this is the side conversation to the why you feel the need to protect Jackie when I come at her. In a battle of wits.
I protect other people that you go after.
Why do you never protect me?
Maybe because in some ways you are like the sensei that doesn't need protection.
That may be.
Do you feel hurt, left out by not being defended? I just defended you right now. I just told people that, in fact, I thought that you were misunderstood and people did not listen to you carefully.
Go ahead.
You know, I have defended you, absolutely. I mean, I'll go back and listen and get some pieces up here. Not for tonight, but go ahead.
Well, yeah, but allowing somebody to paint me as a racist, as a someone who doesn't like black people, and someone who doesn't like women, I think that's what she said yesterday, and allowing that to stand is it's not just.
It's not just?
Well, you didn't tell anybody that you muted me. I just went silent. There are those who thought that I did a hit and run.
I don't think that anybody thought that at all.
Yes, somebody thought that. I can tell you somebody thought that.
Bob?
No, I don't need to say who it is. I got an email. Somebody thought that. Somebody thought that I did a hit and run and bowed out of there real fast, and then let all the shit that I stirred.
Accept my apologies. Not the one angry Jew. Did not hit and run. I muted him as he immediately, in his initial comment to Jack, he said, "How's it feel to How's it feel to have your, I don't remember exactly
what I said, but damage done because she stepped right into it, and you got to love it that everybody went after her who was listening last night. I didn't have to do a thing.
Well, you know, that's why I muted you. Everyone's saying that they had had it with you and they're going to leave the conversation. I could have done that too, but
that's too bad. What a pity party we should have held for them. They're going to leave the conversation. Well, you know what? They don't do that.
You know, the reason I didn't hold the pity party was because you were listening in the background, and I think that you were probably delighting in what you heard. So everyone was served.
I was delighting to a degree you could not even understand. It was brilliant last night.
Oh, I don't underestimate me and my ability to understand certain things.
But I very much enjoyed that last night. That was beautiful.
So, you know, you were not hurt. So I don't know why you're complaining about being muted.
No, because the comment about my not liking black people. You know what I don't like?
I would not bat an eyelash.
Yeah, but you know what I don't like? It wasn't black people and it wasn't women. It's not because Jackie's black. And it's not because she's a female. It's because I think she's stupid.
Well, and that's certainly your assessment of her. And you don't treat her with respect, and she does not like you.
Well, you know, look, that respect is mutual. I listen to her on other shows. She goes after me.
I can remember a show not that far back, the whole thing, when you, so to speak, took over the show, the Jackie did nothing but come to your whole defense for most of the second part of the show, saying, "He didn't say that. He didn't say that. He didn't say that. Why are you guys focusing on what he didn't say?" She came richly to your defense.
Well, let's be clear. She came to my defense because it benefited her.
Well,
she was
doing it out of utter
selfishness.
No, she was doing it out of a sense of justice.
You're going to have to listen to your own Ayn Rand tape so that you understand, because apparently you're not getting it. She did it out of utter selfishness.
But she has come to your defense. I have heard her come to your defense.
I've heard her, too, and I've heard her attack me. So what? Look, yeah. I have seen this before in so many. Who was the last one? Who's the one that always goes, Stormbites, who called originally how much he loved the Jew. I just love the Jew. The Jew's so wonderful. And yet I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, it won't be too long before he comes at me with daggers. So I knew that was bullshit. I knew that was just nothing more than just a Jew.
I think he very genuinely, seriously liked you at some point in time.
He doesn't like me now, does he?
I don't know. I have to ask him. He hasn't been on a long time. He thought that you were disingenuous.
Yeah, maybe he ran away.
But do you deny that Jackie has come to your defense?
No, I don't deny that at all. Why to deny that would mean I would be lying. Why would I deny that?
Well, I just want to make it clear out there that we understand that Jackie is not your, ardent enemy when it comes down. And that's why I don't know why you jump on her and try and needle her and attack her.
Well, I jump on her because she says stupid stuff a lot of times. And it bothers
me. Why don't you just open it that way and say, "Jackie, I can't believe that you just said it, whatever. Could you explain that, elaborate on it, or whatever?"
I don't think she can. That whole thing about Zimmerman, the way I'm explaining.
You could give her a chance. You could give her the opportunity.
I think I've done that.
you might in fact find out that when you don't paint someone in a corner from the onset, that they might very well have a good interaction with you. Just a thought. You know, I'd never let it be said that I tell people how to do or live their lives or how they should do it. You do it your way. But I'm just saying is when you come at someone like that, they get their hackles up. That's been my experience in life. Maybe I just have a weird view of life.
But I like it when people get their hackles up. I like it when people back up against the wall. Did I tell you about my Starbucks conversation?
No, you didn't.
I had a Starbucks conversation a week ago
with
a history professor and a draft dodger, dyed-in-the-wool liberal draft dodger. The draft dodger wasn't scared of me. In fact, we agreed on more than we disagreed. However, the history professor, when he was talking to me, labeled me very early on as a Rush Limbaugh, right-wing, paranoid extremist, something or other. And so when I started questioning him, he backed up into the wall, put his back on the wall. He moved from his chair, moved to the wall, slid sort of into where the counter was, where the counter met the wall, but there was enough space for him to slide in there, and put his back to the wall. You know, I had my son there. I was drinking a cup of coffee. I was just being a lovable little fuzzball. And he had his back to the wall. And I mentioned
Are you an imposing, intimidating figure like that?
Not at all.
You told me you were lovable.
My mental wit put him against the wall like a Jedi mind trick. I am Yoda.
I think this is it. You ready to listen?
Oh, absolutely.
This is Ayn Rand, and we're talking about her and her philosophy, her writings, and this is to do really grave injustice to a person of such depth and insight. So we're going to try our best, poor as it is, to at least expose those of you who haven't had a chance to read her work to where she stands philosophically and what her philosophies are, what her philosophy is. Okay, how do we start? You don't like altruists.
I disapprove of them. I regard them as evil.
Do-gooders. Lord, save me from the do-gooders.
I don't like those popular expressions.
Oh, okay.
That's too narrow and too political.
Okay, but what's bad about the person who wants to help other people?
Well, to begin with, that's the big mistake. People can want to help other people properly and with very good reasons, but that isn't altruism. Altruism doesn't mean merely helping people. It means sacrificing yourself to others, placing the interests of others above your own. It's the self-sacrificing person who is an altruist.
Now, what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with committing suicide? What's wrong with giving up life? And why is the happiness of another person important and good, but not your own? Why are you always the outsider and the sacrificial animal?
Mm-hmm.
For a good relationship, there should be no victims, no sacrifice.
So in a relationship, for example, a man and woman, will talk about the heterosexual world for a moment. To sacrifice for your loved one is, in many cases, then a misnomer. What you're really doing is, tell me what you mean.
What I mean by sacrifice, and what is generally meant, is to give up some value which is important to you for something else which is a lesser value or a non-value.
That's
sacrifice.
And you don't approve of that?
No, I don't. Now, if you love your husband or wife, and you have to, let us say, select between spending money for your spouse if he's ill, or going to a nightclub. It's not a sacrifice to spend money for your spouse if he or she is your value. That is what you want to do.
I see.
But if you let, for instance, your husband die in order to save the neighbor's husband or your wife, that would be altruism. If you reject or pass up something which is, or someone who is valuable to you, mm-hmm. and in favor of somebody who is a neutral stranger or even worse, an enemy, if you sacrifice a friend for an enemy, that's altruism. And the issue there is simply watch the hierarchy of values. If something that is important to you requires a great deal of effort from you, that's not sacrifice. But if you give up your career because you want your competitor or rival to be more successful, that would be a hideous and very evil sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out how this applies to everyday, if you don't, you know, if your wife wants you to go to the A&P and you don't want to go, but you sacrifice because it's for the good of the family, is that okay with you?
Perfectly okay.
But what if you're filled with resentment as you go, wondering why, how come you're always there?
Oh, well, it seems that it's unfair, and if it's not your understanding with your husband that she imposes this on you, then it's perfectly all right to resent it, and properly you should raise the issue and decide what you want to do.
Yeah. Well, I don't understand why this is important. What are the consequences of the traditional notion that we've got here in the Western world that sacrifice is what love is all about?
You know what?
I got to pause that for a second because this was a Phil Donahue interview, and I just have to say to the listening audience that it just boggles my mind that he can't get what she's talking about. So I'm going to continue playing this.
The quickest example that comes to my mind, the newest proposals of having special millions spent of subnormal children and on the handicapped, including the so-called meeting buses, is the attempt to bring everybody to the level of the handicapped. And if it's merely an issue of a physical handicap like a broken leg, which doesn't affect the mind, that would be a little more excusable. So I don't believe that such privileges should be granted to any group. But it includes the mentally retarded, which is the subnormal, the children who are unable to learn, so that at the end of spending thousands or millions of taxpayers' money, you're left with a happy youth who may learn to read and write, may. On the other hand, there are no special schools, or very, very few, for gifted children. And to pass up the gifted, on whom all our lives depend, if it weren't for intelligent people, read Atlas Shrugged, what would happen to us without the better mind, who are able to survive and who carry the weight of everybody else, yet we don't spend any money on them. We do
the applause is for your call for more society energy directed at the accommodation of gifted people.
I hope so.
Okay.
But not government spending. However, so long as you support the ungifted, you owe your first priorities to the gifted.
But what in the Ayn Rand civil context would be appropriate societal measures to accommodate the ungifted?
Their own parents. And a chance to give their parents to earn money. If, however, their parents are poor and cannot assume it's a big heavy burden, then you can appeal to private charity, as it was always done before welfare statism in this country.
You want private charity as well for the gifted?
It must say, they usually, in a free society, they will need it. They'll make their own way, just so you don't stop them. But private charity cannot be done by means of tax collection, which means by force. Private charity is up to you, and it is a worthy cause. That is, let's say, a vulnerable child who certainly cannot help him. It's perfectly all right to help him, but not at the sacrifice of your own child.
You'd probably like to get rid of HEW then.
Oh, certainly. Oh, certainly. Much more than that. I'd like to get rid of.
A lot of the government, huh?
Everything except the basic duties of the government, which is police, law courts, armed forces.
You want less government. Well, everybody says that. It's a little hard to put that into effect when we've got a country that has such a maldistribution of wealth. You'll give me that, huh? Too few rich, too many poor.
I will give you part of that, because if there is a maldistribution, it's to those who have political coup. If some of your money is made with government help and government favoritism, then I venture that is unfair and improper and unjust. But if you made it yourself in free competition, enough people want to pay you for your services or your product, then you should keep all of it. Why shouldn't you? You made it.
All right. Okay.
She's talking about altruism there, but she uses that pretty much interchangeably with selfish, which is what we were talking about. Did you like that piece? You can actually, I put a link in the chat room to it. It's broken up into five sections. It was a full interview with her, with Phil Donahue, years and years and years and years ago. God, how long has it been since Phil's been gone? I can't even remember. Most of you people might not even know who Phil Donahue is. So, did you like that piece?
Wait. Phil Donahue is dead?
No, he's still around. He's not on the air anymore right now.
I'm not surprised.
He might be doing radio, but I don't think he's on television. He made his...
I thought he was doing That Girl.
Let's see. He's born 35. He's still alive. We look it up on the internet and stuff. He is. He's actually not that old. 77. He's top.
I thought he was doing That Girl.
I didn't catch that last one. That girl.
That girl.
Oh, Marlo Thomas. I don't. Yeah.
There you go.
I don't know what
a way to dissect some wit, I'll tell you.
It didn't come across it much. It was much like I didn't put the two together right away. Anyway, Phil Donahue was a liberal television talk show host, and I'm surprised he even did this interview with Ayn Rand. I found it on YouTube. And happened to break it down. It's on five parts, and you can get it on dogmaticdogma.com.
I have no doubt that it caused him fitful nights of no sleep and nightmares.
So ultimately, what you're saying, and I don't find that all that hard. I think that ultimately, everyone does is self-serving. Even me, when I have you on, do you feel good
even
now?
Even Catholic priests. Imagine having this conversation with a Jesuit. Which I have had.
The problem with you having a conversation with a college professor is that they are out. That really is akin to sexual.
I didn't say he
was
a college professor. I said he was a history professor.
History professor. Okay.
He was a history teacher.
Well, teacher is more accurate. If you say professor, I tend to jump to college because you don't have to be a professor
to teach
in high schools. But,
yeah,
I don't think you were misleading me. I just added that.
That's right.
But history professors, whether it be in college or high school, have captive audiences, and they're rarely questioned. I had a good friend that I was in Vietnam with that used to like to go into the classroom in the junior college, and he was a big guy. He was 6'5", 6'6", and he probably ran 250 pounds. And he would sit in there, and when they'd get on some sort of a rant, he'd raise his hand, and he would tell them. Is the next time you come in here and try and start spouting your opinion is fact in a class that you're teaching, I want you to make sure that you have a milk carton or soapbox to stand on so these kids know that you're giving them your opinion, and what your opinion has nothing to do with the subject matter that you're trying to teach. And they usually quit pontificating. Yeah, well, that's a terrible thing about college, because especially I would say it's more so in the liberal arts, because when you get in the hard sciences, chemistry, physics, math, the things that they're teaching are fairly straightforward. When you get into things like theoretical linear algebra and matrices and vector spaces and stuff like that, that doesn't deal much with sociological, societal interpretations. They don't get into politics a lot. They stay out of that, and they're pretty much on topic. In many of the classes at places like UCSC, they go adrift from what they're really there to teach. They're there to, especially in the community studies department, they're there to shape, mold, and direct societies. But he really backed his back up against the wall with you.
Oh, yeah. In fact, he got even closer to the wall when I made a point of noticing that he put his back to the wall.
I wish you'd had a camera and a tripod, and you could have said, "Wait, so I can film this, so I can show it to others."
No, I can duplicate it at will. The barista, a very attractive woman, was very close during the discussion, about an hour and a half. And after it was over, she said to me that she's not allowed to involve herself in the discussion, but she would have liked to. She was a political science major in college, or she's still in college, and was a political science major. But she said to me that, she said, "That was a very smart man." She says, "I have never seen him as defensive as he was with you." To which I was not surprised. Because as skillfully as I manipulate the people on Blog Talk Radio, it's even easier to do it face-to-face.
Okay, see if you can see about heavy weapons gay here. Do you have anything of substance to contribute to the conversation?
What the fuck you talking about?
It is good to have a giant man.
You got to wash your ass.
So anyway, this was during my trying to give up BTR, which I pretty much have. You should be honored that I have left your show in the mix. Because really, there's not much else on BTR that I really care about.
You're trying to kick the habit cold turkey. Weaning off.
I have work to do, but you have an intellectual level that most other people in BTR can't attain, which is why I like you and you like me.
Well, that gives me another piece to get into here, and you'd like to probably contribute on this one. Do you get anything from the Cato Institute?
Sure. I was just going to say that we both give good intellect. Burn.
Well, I certainly try to. Even, you know, it's amazing to me that people like heavy weapons gay out there have nothing better to do with their time. They're kind of silly, you know. There was some last night.
Well, wait a second. I destroy. I go into chat rooms and I go into the BTR shows and I turn them upside down. And I get great enjoyment out of that. Is there something wrong with me?
Well, no. You know, hosts have an option to kick you too if they choose. You know, I usually don't kick. I only kick people at a certain point. There's some stuff that's just inane, absolutely inane. And I have muted you from time to time. strictly because you were just so annoying to some of the people. I don't know why I do that. You're absolutely right. I think that if people are adults, they should be able to handle you.
Well, and certainly you're not affording them the opportunity of bettering themselves or sharpening their own wit, because certainly I am a wit sharpener.
I don't know that everything you've ever put in chat rooms is always wit sharpening. I've read some of your stuff in there, not a lot. As you know, I don't monitor the chat room very much. I go back and forth from time to time to see what's going on. But for the most part, I let it play out. It's
going head to
way.
Head with me is wit sharpening. It's like a stump to a knife.
Someone in chat, go head to head with not the one angry Jew, and put him in his place. That is a challenge from the host.
That is a challenge, and there's been so many who think that they can, and no one's ever done that.
I'm trying to think of who I know that might be. The people I know that probably could do it have dismissed you.
Bring them on. Well, they dismiss me because they don't want to challenge me.
No. Why? You know, some of them believe that you engage in sophistry and they're not interested in engaging in sophistry. I've had people comment that you engage in pill pull. Like that.
In what?
In pill pull. Hebrew term, loosely meaning sharp analysis, refers to a method of studying the Talmud through intense textual whatever. In other words, bouncing back and forth, going from one subject to another. Anyway, but that's their choice. That's their choice. Okay. Why don't you, go ahead. Yeah, Lisa Migraine doesn't want to take you on. Here's something I want to get into with you, okay, because you're one of these, okay, the rise and fall of the global standard in the United States. This is a Cato Institute piece that just came out June 20, 2013. Have you seen it? Three things I'd like to cover between now and night's over is maybe kick this around, because it talks about fiat currency and the evolution of gold standard and the fiat currency in our country. Another one has to do with something that I think it's underappreciated. People get out there and they talk about, there was this big ado about sexual harassment and rape in the military, but no one ever includes the fact that males compromise a tremendous amount of number of rapes in the military. And I'd like to kick that around with you and get your input on that, see what you have to say about it. And the third thing, there was a study that just came out, and it was the rise of suicides among military veterans. And it referred heavily to a VA study. I don't know if you read the study, looked at the study, or any of that stuff. But what it really came down to, this was another example of a masterful manipulation by the media based on counting on people not to check out the report. It actually turns out that even though suicides are on the rise in the military, they've gone up some, not nearly at the rate they have in the private sector. So in a way, it's kind of a non-story. It's kind of a story that the military actually has better adjusted people, if you will. Since I'm talking about that, let's get into that one right now. Are you acquainted with the study? It was done by the VA?
No, but I've seen it thrown around on BTR.
Yeah, well, it's not only running around on BTR, it's running around on Facebook. And what amazes me is that for the most part, in my interactions and experience with people, they will run with stuff and never bother to check it out for themselves. You know, this. So it started off as baffling rise in suicide plagues the U.S. military. Specialist Freddie Hook, a medic with the Army 82nd Airborne Division, killed himself in 2010. The trail of possible cause seemed long. The trial of possible causes seemed long. you'd use, you know, you start using illegal drugs, you're going to have problems and all that. But it goes on and on. When you go down farther, you get into a point where what comes up is that the number of suicides among the military is actually lower. And what's interesting about it is the number of suicides, I don't know what that big, that hiss is in the background there. And it, that hiss is coming from your end because I muted it and I can still hear it here. There. What did you do?
I muted.
There it's gone. Do you have any, what, you have background noise going on? You have fans or anything like that?
It's only 100 degrees.
Well, okay, that could be what it is. But it turns out when you read the VA study, you know, I started going up. I said, okay, what does this really say? It turns out that among young people, because the implication seems to be that our young soldiers going over to Iraq and Afghanistan are out of that experience are starting to commit, you know, tremendous suicides. But when you look at the actual study, what you find is that's not where the suicides are on the rise. It's in, you know, amongst the older veterans, people that are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. So that would not explain anything going on now. You're trying to correlate it to what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. And when you look at the comparison of suicides among the among veterans versus in the private sector, they're much lower. Now, why would they leave that out of the study? That's absolutely nonsense to me. And people go nuts about it. See what it's doing to our veterans. Here it is. Here, give you some 29 years and younger. Non-veterans, 21.6%. Veterans, 6%. VHA veterans are 3%, 30 to 39, 19.3, 9.1, 9.1 among veterans, 5.2 among VHA veterans, 40
and
to 49.
And where do dentists fit in?
Say that again?
Where do dentists come up? What percentage?
For committing suicide, I don't know if they had that in this study. Cause people
well, you
are
always
to
hear that dentists are one of the highest suicide rates.
Yeah, I know. I've definitely heard that, but they don't have them in here. Maybe the dentists account for the higher non-veteran suicide rates. I don't know. But the other thing about the study is it didn't include all the states, all 50 states. It didn't include, and yet people are running with this thing, trying to build a case for how terrible the suicide rates are among servicemen, and because they can't handle the stress and pressure. I was down at the VA recently, and I'll give you another example too. This veteran was down there; he was a young guy. And what happens down at the VA? You're seeing more and more older guys. I don't see as many young veterans. Not that there aren't young veterans coming back that are eligible for VA and stuff. And he was there for something, and. And I got talking to him. He was a Ranger, and Rangers are more heavily trained than the standard infantrymen. And we got talking, and I finally asked him. I says, "Asked, do you have post-traumatic stress disorder?" He said, "Nope." And he'd been on five tours over there, five deployments. Well, we got talking, and this is another thing in terms of manipulation by the press, in terms of language, counting on people that don't understand what they're talking about and never bothering to figure it out. And he says, "Oh, but those weren't all full, you know, full year tours. Those were, you know, a month here, a mission there, you know." So his five tours, I think he was there a total of 6 months. 6 months, you know, a tour of duty during Vietnam was 1 year, tour 365, they called it. During World War II, and I believe the same was true in Korea, is the tour of duty was for the duration of the war. When you went overseas during World War II, you were there till it was over. And yet we have a population that just seems to me is not willing to take the time to understand things and put them into perspective. It's like my opening show when I was talking about what do people mean by when they say that the jury in the Trayvon Martin case was racist. Are they saying the only way that the jury would not be racist is they came back with a guilty verdict independent of whether the evidence sustained that verdict or not?
Seems to me I heard there was one black woman on that jury and the rest of them were white. But one black woman could have thrown the whole monkey wrench into the works if that's what everybody was expecting.
Yeah,
and she could have said, nope, I don't want to, I think he's guilty.
It was actually one Hispanic woman that was on the jury. I went through the jury makeup last night. But all it took was one to hang the jury, right? And if the jury was hung, then it would decide whether to retry it or not, or let him go. But for one of the things, don't let this go to your head now. I'm sure it will, because you're getting a compliment from the host here on BTR, as I brought up the point, is does that say something about women jurors? When people are saying that the jury was, in fact, prejudiced, I think the prosecution was thought that a whole all-female jury would go in their favor, number one. I know that the closing arguments, I listened to part of the closing arguments, they were not based very much on the data. I heard the closing prosecution say, you know, go with common sense. Well, common sense is not always common sense, number one. And the judge gave the prosecution, they couldn't have asked for more. The charges were second-degree murder. The judge allowed them to consider manslaughter as an alternative verdict. He wasn't charged with manslaughter, a lowering of the bar for what had to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Let me jump in here for a second. It sounds to me, and I heard a description of the jurors, what they do. It sounds to me like you had a jury full of smart women.
Now, do you say that because you got the verdict that you wanted to see out of the case?
No, the description of what these women do or did describe some intelligent women.
See, it's when you say that only one verdict leads to a non-racist jury, then you might as well throw the whole legal defense, the legal system out.
You know what? Let's throw it out on the table because no one else will do it, and I'm not afraid to do it. But this country has been held in a vice grip by the black community and the black racist race baiters who manipulate the media and manipulate the politicians, who are aided and abetted by the politicians and the media in their manipulation. They are gladly manipulated because it's what they want. And the rest of America is supposed to sit there and shut up while all the black people complain about how horrible everything is. Bullshit.
Well, I don't think it's all the black people complaining. I mean, I won't paint it with that broad a brush either. I think that the demographics among the black community are as diverse as they are among the white community. I think
wait a second. Most black people will vote Democratic. Agree or disagree?
Well, that is true.
A major majority of them will vote Democratic. Well, look, Jews do the same thing. But a major majority of them will vote Democratic.
What's that say about Jews?
It says that they've forgotten their roots is what it says.
Can you explain? I don't understand that. I live in a community that's got a lot of Jewish roots and are very nice people, and they're the first ones
that want to disarm everybody.
Is critical thinking. I mean, it just isn't there. I see some of the stuff that comes out of there People are certainly entitled to believe whatever they wish. But
because most of them are liberals before they're Jews. Which is the same thing with the black community. They've become liberals before they're black. Before they're anything. They're all just liberals. And they all have there seems to be a mind think that they all share. Everybody knows this, but no one will touch it. No one will talk about it. Except the Jew. Jew will talk about it.
I don't think that you're the only one who would talk about it. I know many people who would talk about it. The problem is, how do you get in that conversation? It is my struggle when I do talk radio, not just BTR or whatever, is people's passions. And I'm not saying there's no place for passion. There's a lot of place for passion in life. And certain, you know, when you, I'm not going to analytically think out things when it comes down, you know, to being in the bedroom or sex or good food, wine. You know, there's a lot of room for passion in the world. But I know that when it comes down to court of law, like they say, you know, I have a good attorney friend that always likes to say there's a saying about the law, and that is the loser cries in the courthouse, in the courtroom, the winner cries on the steps of the courtroom, saying that ultimately in most legal decisions, no one comes out happy. Now, that's not always the case, you know, that's, you know, but that being said, is it's impossible. I got into a discussion with a relative of mine not that long ago. We were talking about all this stuff about gun laws. Now, if you assert to me that you want more stringent gun laws, more gun control on what are called assault-style weapons and all that stuff, and your assertion is that it's going to reduce the number of mass shootings and deaths, I would expect you to know something about the statistics surrounding those issues. But most people don't. I had a conversation with someone down at the recycle center here, and we started getting into it. I said, how many weapons have been involved in mass shootings over the last 30 years? This is from Mother Jones, by the way. Mother Jones. Oh, you know, you're trying to trick me. No, I just want to know. You're saying that we need these laws. We need laws to restrict assault-style weapons. How many have been used in mass shootings over the last 30 years? My source is Mother Jones. That's not considered a conservative magazine by any stretch of the imagination. Well, I didn't know how many. Well, 100, I think it was 149. I could pull those up and look the article up. It doesn't matter. Well, how many of them were assault-style rifles? Oh, you're trying to? No, I'm not trying to. I'm trying to find out what you know. What you're asserting is we need more stringent gun laws and this and that. You're asserting there's a problem that the laws can deal with. Turns out there are 39. Like 39 were used. How many of them were purchased illegally? There's a point at which, you know, I don't care how many laws you have, the differential and the difference you're going to make in the shootings just doesn't exist. It's like the Sandy Hook thing, even though you at one point in time seemed to think that that was a government, some nefarious things going on.
I didn't say that. I said that there was something not right there. I didn't know what it was.
But even in that one, as they say, the shooter, you know, all the guns were in fact collected, were obtained legally. To what extent are people going to give up their rights for some of that safety? I understand. I live close to Salinas, California, which has a fairly high number of gang shootings. We don't have many here, although there was finally one or two gang shootings over the last 5 years in the area. It happens, and I could take a bullet, but I'm going to tell you what, if I in my will, I would not want people to make the gun laws more stringent. You can't legislate crazy. But this person in my family, I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to talk about it. We don't need that many guns, you know, and we, you know, whatever. And I go, you know, wow, you know, same thing with this whole thing on carbon and global warming and climate change. Most people couldn't even tell you the amount of man-made carbon in the atmosphere, our contribution that's supposed to be causing all this stuff. Is human beings contribute something like 3% to the total amount of carbon dioxide put in the atmosphere. And the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is a small fraction itself of the total greenhouse effect, as they call it. When you get down to it, you can do the calculations. They're not very complicated. They're pretty straightforward. All the information. I don't want to be bothered with that. Can't you see? It was hot today. Then it's not hot, and you say, "Wow, where's the heat?" Well, you know, it's just the weather. It's just the weather, you know. The weather changes, but the next time there's a hot day, there's just something about the human mind that doesn't seem to like to deal well with logical issues, if you will, when it's applicable. When it comes to religion and things like that, that's a whole different ball of wax. I don't try and apply science or my scientific training or any hypotheses or theories to religion. That's outside. That's in the metaphysical realm, and I have a hard time understanding that aspect of humanity. I really do. Even to the point of the fiat money stuff that you're so focused on is if everyone all of a sudden agrees that it's not worth everything, we're in deep shit. You're absolutely right. Until then, it has purchasing power. And if everyone goes to gold standard and decides, well, gold's really not worth anything either, you can't eat it, won't warm your house, won't keep you warm, won't buy you love and stuff, you know, gold will have no value. You know, its value is based on the fact that people have found it rare. It's been a rare metal. People agreed at one point in time that gave it some value because they're hard to get. But this article here by Cato Institute, it says this is an informal discussion, and even in some academic writings, a tendency to treat the this is in informal discussions and even in some academic writings, a tendency to treat U.S. monetary history is divided between a gold standard past and a fiat dollar present. In truth, the legal meaning of a standard U.S. dollar has been contested often hotly throughout U.S. history, and a functioning, if not formally acknowledged, gold standard was in effect for less than a quarter of the full span of U.S. history. I didn't know that. You know, you listen to people yell and scream about the fiat money, you'd think that it was gold and then it was fiat. And all of a sudden, things had been stolen away. So I started going through this article. Bimetallism from 1792 to 1834, the United States was functionally on a silver standard. From the Civil War until 1879, a fiat greenback standard predominated, with the exception of a few states such as California, Oregon, where a gold standard continued to operate. The classical gold standard era lasted until about World War I. Did you know all that? I didn't. This paper reviews the history of the gold standard in the United States, explaining both how that standard came into being, despite having been neither formally provided for nor informally established at the nation's inception, and how it eventually came to an end. It concludes that the conditions that led to the gold standard's original establishment and its successful performance are unlikely to be replicated in the future. I've always found it interesting. People say, you know, yeah, what you want to do is invest in gold because that's, this, your fiat money's not worth anything. But they always point to the fact that gold has gone up in value, but its value is always in fiat money. You know, it was, you know, $700 per ounce yesterday. Now it's $900 per ounce. Now $1,200 per ounce. But in what is it $700 per ounce? In your same fiat currency that you're saying is worthless. What's that mean? I think it's a very interesting article. Gold standard defined. Any history of the gold standard must begin with a clear description of what such a standard is and, no less importantly, what it isn't. In a genuine gold standard, the basic monetary unit is a specific weight of gold alloy some specific purity or its equivalent in fine gold, and prices are expressed in the unit or in some fractional units based upon it. The other requirement for a genuine gold standard is that actual exchange media other than full-bodied coins themselves must consist either of paper money that is readily convertible by either domestic or foreign holders into full-bodied coin or token of subsidiary coins, generally speaking, small fractions of the standard money unit. As for what a gold standard is not, it is not, first of all, a standard or measure of value. Under a gold standard, prices, not values, are expressed in gold units, and those prices indicate nothing more concerning values than the sellers of goods value of the gold in question more than the goods are prepared to exchange for it. More than the goods they are prepared to exchange for it. So there's an arbitrary value on the gold that's put on the seller. There's no inherent value. And what was fascinating about this piece to me as I started to read it tonight, I only got a bit into it, we can go farther, is that I didn't notice. I hear all the stuff back and forth about the fiat money, and I've heard it for a long time. Nor is the existence of a gold standard a matter of gold coins being legal tendered having legal tender status. Substantial backing of paper money by gold is also both unnecessary and insufficient to make such paper as good as gold.
How many bullets do you have?
How many bullets do I have?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you asked? I don't have any.
You don't own any guns?
I don't own any guns, no. I could wind up shooting someone.
Well, why don't you just buy bullets?
Well, bullets could be a currency of exchange. You know, things get tough and tight. Could be a very good medium exchange. I have a friend that recommends the Box of the Month Club to avoid anyone getting their panties in a pinch because you're buying ammo.
Well, I think that if things really get bad and gold isn't wanted as a medium of exchange, I would think that bullets would be a really good thing to have.
Well, I think the bullets would be a good medium of exchange. I think food would be a good medium of exchange if you have it. It could get to the point that water or some method of purifying and providing water could be a good medium of exchange. I think that the water purification straws could be an excellent medium of exchange because the new nanofilters, I think they make the nanofilter tube straws. You can pretty much drink out of the toilet and nothing comes through them except water. And water is a very important resource. There's a lot of mediums of exchange, if it ever gets to that, that would be absolutely useful, even if gold wasn't. There's another thing, though, that's a problem, and even though you disparaged to a certain extent Stormbites that he brought up, is that when we live in societies with centralized services, what you have is only ultimately useful to the point that you run out. To the extent your whole community is prepared, you may be prepared, but it's a thing, and I've said it before, the stuff of which horror movies are made. You know, everyone's starving to death except Joe down the street, he wakes up in the morning, has a smile on his face, and he ain't getting skinny. He must be hiding some food. You know, for me to be prepared, living in a city or town, I'm only so prepared as I can get people who think that I'm not prepared and in dire straits like them. If we get to that point, and it's not all that unlikely that it will, it's interesting to see how people will survive and what they'll do to survive. I've often said that I would rather be with people with skills rather than people that were able to text and do all that kind of stuff. I want someone with some sort of handy skill, someone that's able to use tools, someone that's able to contribute in that way. And I don't think it's that unrealistic to actually plan for or consider a major disaster. You know, we are so electronically dependent right now. It's like I've said before, in Santa Cruz, they clipped a fiber optics cable into town, and people went nuts. People just went absolutely apeshit. I mean, they couldn't do anything. Businesses came to a standstill, except one or two that still had some of the old credit card machines. You probably remember them that you used to swipe a card. They had some of the slips, and they wrote down the credit card numbers and made the imprint on the slip, and we were able to buy some things. My granddaughter was up visiting. Which, by the way, has this ever happened to you? I got a call on Friday. It's totally unrelated to what I'm talking about, but it deals with the electronic world. I got a call from my bank. I was out, and my one card had been rejected. So I went to a credit card. I usually try and use credit cards out there, because if something gets compromised, what you're compromised on is your line of credit. It's not your cash account. I came home, and my combo ATM credit card had shown up and been swiped. Country of origin was Russia, to buy some $150 worth of goods from Home Depot. I've never had that happen before. You ever had anything like that happen before? Quite interesting.
Yes. My PayPal card was used in Ohio.
Did they cash before it got charged?
I got an email as soon as the transaction went through.
They stopped mine immediately and called me and said, "Are you traveling?" I says, "Nope."
No, yeah, nobody stopped it. I saw the email from the transaction that told me what the transaction was and where it was. So when I saw a transaction from a Walmart in Ohio, I called and had I turned the card off. I could do that online.
Yeah, I've got credit cards out there, folks. This is not unusual, and I don't even know. I was thinking about that the other day. I can't remember. I could count the number of digits on there, but whether it got stolen from a compromised database or not, or whether they I'm sure it wouldn't be that efficient to randomly generate these things, because you go through a whole lot of them that didn't have numbers. Raley's, one of the supermarkets in my area, their databases were compromised. I have all my stuff set up for warning as soon as it happens, because in this technological age, there's big money in stealing these things. But it was kind of a surprise and a shock. I laughed, and you know what I told her? I says, "Tell him I think it was Edward Snowden." She didn't get it. Do you get it?
Barely.
Edward Snowden is in Russia right now. The charges mm-hmm. came from Russia.
How do you know that?
That's what they told me.
That's what they tell you. He may not be there.
No, I know. Maybe they didn't. But just based on that, if they came from Russia, then in fact, I made the comment that Edward Snowden must have been up to no good over there, or maybe the NSA was in fact using all that data they'd stolen to finance their operations. That would have been a good one. You know, it's just like locksmith work. You know, the minute they come up with new locks, they're coming up with new tools to break through them. I remember years ago, with all the newer locks, it's probably getting harder. I haven't done lockout work on cars in a long time. But you know, Medico.
You know anybody who knows how to break a Medico lock?
Yeah. I've seen picking demonstrations online of people who have picked them in 3 minutes.
Have to be pretty good to do that.
Oh yeah, they were. That's one of the fun things. If you ever get a chance, go to a locksmith convention and watch the competitions. They are fun watching these guys pick locks, impression keys for locks. Schlage has a sidebar system that actually works pretty good. The kind of lock that, not the one Angry Jew is talking about, Medico has pins that have to be aligned in an angle in the key, and they're cut at angles. They have what's called a mushroom or spool pin in there, which means that when you try and twist the thing, the upper pins bind. But people can, in fact, pick them. In fact, you know what? When I was learning to do locksmith work, I literally picked, I didn't pick a Medico, but I picked a lock with spool pins in them. What a spool pin is, it looks like a sewing thread spool. You know, it hangs out on the edges and the main body's thin, and when you're picking a lock, you got to turn the cylinder with that cutout, it can bind so it can't freely go up and down. And I would practice lock picking on my front door and could never figure out why it was so hard until I had to rekey the place for the owners at one particular point in time. And when I took it apart and was dumping some of the top master pins, lo and behold, what came out was spool pins. No wonder that damn thing was hard to pick. But yeah, I've seen some stuff of people picking medical locks online. It's pretty fascinating to watch them do it. Then some of the newer locks are interesting things. I think they're a lot of fun. Haven't done a lot of locksmith work lately, and a lot of people probably don't know about Medico. Schlage has a combination pin sidebar lock that the audience probably isn't really even interested in finding about. Most people probably don't care one iota about locks. Other than, have you ever heard of lock bumping?
No.
Has anyone in the chat room heard of lock bumping? Lock bumping is, I'm not going to tell you what it is. It's something that goes around, and what lock bumping is, and they have demonstrations of it on YouTube and stuff. It's not always quite as easy as they demonstrate. It depends on where the lock knob and handle is you use a key that's totally overcut on all the cuts that you use, and the shoulder is overcut so it can go a little farther, and you put turning pressure on it and you whack it with a hammer, and it's got the ramps for the lower pins on the diamonds, and it knocks them all at once, and with that tension on there, it's like hitting the billiard ball in the pool hall, where you whack it and the billiard ball stays there, knocks all the pins at once. With a little bit of practice, people get pretty good at that. Every so often, they do a thing on bumping on the local news here. And the thing about bumping is that it allows people to open the thing just like picking. It takes a little bit of practice, too. That all takes practice. And people that do it certainly do some pretty good demos on it. You can buy bump keys online, too. They're not illegal. You can buy... It's one of the things, like on the gun thing, I have pointed out before, while everyone's trying to go background checks and stuff, you can get perfectly legal semi-automatic rifles and buy yourself a bump stock. You know what that is? Have you seen the bump stocks?
Yep.
They're a stock. Yeah, and they will give you damn near full-on automatic capabilities with a standard. Semi-automatic rifle. What you do is you pull the rifle into your finger. The recoil of the rifle kicks it back, and it bumps forward into your finger. And with a little bit of practice, these guys are getting 600-700 rounds per minute out of them. You know, full on automatic M16 is like.
Of course, at today's cost for ammunition, that'd be quite expensive.
No, it'd be quite expensive, but the point is, my only point is not that you should do that. Everyone's afraid of assault rifles. I would not give our military assault rifles. I keep telling people, if you know what an assault rifle is, it's just cosmetically altered. I want my military to be outfitted with the best hardware if they're doing their job, if they're trying to take over the country and work at the behest of the government and take over my house, then I want them to have assault rifles. But if they're out there doing the legitimate work of the military, I want them to have a full-on automatic weapon. That being said, if you buy a bump stock, they're totally they're unregulated by the ATF. You can write and ask about it and what they say. Anyway, the last time I checked, what they will tell you is, yeah, we don't have anything to do with it. That's an accessory. We don't not regulate it or whatever. And this $350 item can take your rifle and make it effectively equivalent to an automatic. People that practice with them practice to get good at three-round bursts, like military and stuff do too. Because like you say, using full-on automatic is a waste of ammo. Most people who go full automatic miss a lot of stuff unless they're in the movies. So what do you think about rape in the male military rape? Male military rape survivors speak out. Now, for the guys that are listening, I want you to put yourself in this position. This article published May 17, 2013. You know, we had all the stuff break about rapes in the military. Part of the thing that I thought is crazy is one of the things problems the military ran into was exactly the problem the military said that they were worried about if they introduced women in the military. And I'm not knocking women. It has to do with biology between men and women. And lo and behold, it happened, and everyone's got their panties in a pinch, which they should, but I don't know whether we'll be able to do away with it. But here we go, you know. Male survivors of rape while serving in the military say they are often deemed liars and troublemakers when they report abuse. The Pentagon estimated about 13,000 men serving in the military suffered sexual assault last year. NBC reported about 12,100 women in uniform were sexually assaulted on an active duty year. So more men are sexually assaulted every year than women. Did you know that?
No, but I guess it's time for the gays to get their turn at the top. What was that? What was that thing the military did where they? It was a big deal a long time ago. Where a bunch of the top brass were sexually harassing all the women in their command.
Well, it turns out that one of the top brass was in charge of the sexual harassment abatement program, was actually sexually harassing women. But I don't know what happened.
Now, why should that be a surprise? If child molesters always go looking for jobs in schools and places where kids are, so it's not a surprise.
And by the way, what I want to throw out there for the listening audience is I just threw a typical news media trick at you. I didn't tell you any lies, but I totally misled you, because the thing I didn't tell you when I read the piece, which is important in putting into perspective, yeah, more men are raped every year than women. But the question that should have been going through your minds, in my humble opinion, is, well, what percentage is that? That's 13,000 men out of 1.2 million versus 12,100 women out of 203,000. So clearly the number, I didn't do the percentages and stuff, but that just off the top looks substantially greater to me. That's 101 out of roughly 12 out of 300 in the women. I'll pull up the thing. But that's what the news media do. They sensationalize things, and they don't give you the whole picture. So it's not that male rapes or male sexual harassment in the service isn't a problem. But is it on the same order of problem as women? But there, and the other thing, though, is if you're going to talk about sexual harassment in the service, you know, men have a right to be not sexually harassed every bit as much as women do. Except men aren't supposed to report it or be upset about it.
Oh, are you going to tell me now that in prisons we should people should be safe?
Yeah, I am. There should be no place
about that?
In the. I think that in prison that should be the safest place physically that you could ever go to.
And yet it isn't. And when somebody is sexually accosted in prison, the animals outside of prison, who probably ought to belong in the prison with them, will say, oh, well, that's good. They deserved it.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely a travesty. I think if you're being, I think that prison should be the safest place you could go for your physical well-being. Really, that's my personal opinion. You are a ward of the state in the ultimate then, and if they can't protect you life and limb, there's something problematic about that, and we should do something about that. I think that that's terrible and atrocious. But you're absolutely right. People make jokes about it all the time. We all know what's going to happen. You see it in all the movies.
Because most people are brainless thugs. Do you know why I'm weaning myself away from BTR? Not so much your show, but all the other shows?
No.
Because they don't deserve me.
Or maybe they really do deserve you.
I'm way too good for them. I give such good radio. I'm way too good for them.
By the way, that translates to roughly 6% of the women in the military are raped versus 1% of the men, if you do the math. But I'm amazed that people don't ask those questions. Is someone tell you? Know, it's like when I get into the it's when I get into the global warming or climate change stuff with people. I know people read all this stuff, and I know all of it, but it seems to me the first thing I started asking years ago is, okay, let's assume for the moment that the temperatures are rising. Is that necessarily a bad thing? You know, if you do and you look out, there are more people freeze to death than die of heat. Maybe that's not all that bad a thing. And then people say, well, you know, you look at Al Gore's, you know, Earth and Alerts, whatever. You read his book out there, or An Inconvenient Truth. I don't know how many of you saw Inconvenient Truth. What I did is I started my stopwatch when they touched on anything that had to do with science. And I stopped it when they stopped and went on when, and he self-aggrandized and talked about the wonderful stuff he did. And by the end of a 90-minute, 100-minute movie, he'd talked exactly 12 to 15 minutes about anything science-related. Most of it was tangential and wrong, but 10 to 15% of the movie had anything to do with it. But it was sensational. People show you a picture. I thought about this a long time ago. I see these maps of the ozone layer. I see these big glossy pictures, the color pictures on the front page, and they look dramatic. But I ask myself, is what's the, you know, first of all, it's a thinning, not zero. Second of all, it occurs, the biggest place it occurs is over Antarctica during the dark cycle. And what happens is it's a photochemical reaction, sunlight initiated. So what happens is, boom, the sunlight creeps over the horizon and whatever fluorocarbons are down there, you know, you initiate that reaction for a temporary period of time, you have a thinning. It always amazed me is how molecules were smart enough to go up the upper atmosphere and make their way down south and avoid all the other oxygen molecules and light photons coming in up there. It also turns out that the ozone layer, I think, is something like 2 to 3 millimeters thick. Do you happen to remember what it is?
No.
The atmosphere goes up, you know, quite a few miles. If you were to knock out that first layer, then the impinging sunlight should hit the next layer of oxygen up there. Here it is. 1 Dobson is, that's the measurement. But it seems to me there's so many other questions to be asked that even the scientists don't ask them. And I think that in large part is the commitment is not to the truth, not to the science, but protecting my reputation of being someone that's an expert in the field. And notwithstanding any of that, is even if the planet is heating up and there's nothing we can do about it, and we've reached the tipping point, which, by the way, if you listen to someone by the name of Bill McGibbon, we reached that, it turns out, in 1992, the optimum level. We should never go over 350 parts per million. We reached that 20 years ago. Then it's too late. What are we going to do? And I hear well, this wonderful rendition about the poles, in fact, reflecting the light, and as they melt, that increases the amount of heat that gets trapped because we don't reflect it back. Well, right now, what is it? Land mass, solid land mass compromises, what, 25% of the Earth's atmosphere, and the poles are a fraction of that. So you're talking about them decreasing, even though it's a large change, it's in a small amount. And you look at the melting since the last ice ages, I think, you know, the ice is about 90% melted, but no one ever deals with those questions. No one asks them because it's either we're in deep shit. We've hit that tipping point. Bill Hansen bothers me. He's supposed to be a scientist. NASA, watch out for us. So they interview him on someplace like 60 Minutes. They asked him, when did you decide to get involved in this? When my grandchildren came up to me and says, well, Grandpa, what are you doing about this? Well, I thought the science was supposed to be committed to some sort of an objective view of the problem. But no. You know, we live in a world that is very much upside down and very much run by, and I'm not saying there again that there's anything wrong with
the world. We live in a world of stupid.
Idiocracy, that great movie. Did you ever see that one?
Yes.
I mean, there is very much idiocracy. You know, just because it makes sense doesn't mean that it's true. And if more people would question, you know, maybe it does. All you're going to find out if you dig in, question, and look up is you're going to find out it's true or not. But I'm just amazed at how much people are willing to accept. It's like on there again, Facebook, Twitter, all these things, you know. People post. They post this heart-wrenching picture of this soldier that committed suicide. I feel terrible for his family. I mean, I don't feel terrible for him. I don't know. I think it's a sad, tragic thing, and I don't know why he did it. But there's a part of me that also thinks, you know, think of the men that stormed Normandy during World War II. I mean, a lot of men got killed in there. A lot of men came back from World War II, and they sat on it, buried it, and went on with it and lived in it. That's a terrible thing. If anything, as I've made the case to people, is when you have post-traumatic stress disorder and it's on the rise, it's actually might be a statement more of the fact that society is becoming more civilized in that it has less tolerance for killing. It doesn't do very well with it. There was a point in time in the evolution of humankind, I've said this before, where it was a real honor to be a warrior, to go out and do battle, you know, and the more proficient you were at taking life, the more you were respected, a warrior culture. We've gotten to the point that, I'm not cut out to be a warrior, otherwise I would have stayed in the army. Even then, I wasn't a warrior. I was combat support in the army. Be very clear about that. I was not really fond about having to shoulder a rifle pack and my gear and go walk in those days through rice paddies. But I have a high degree of respect to people that are willing to do that. And we have all this stuff about, you know, corrupt government. We have a corrupt government, but we don't do anything about it. We talk about it. I was talking with Bob last night when he called in, and he says, well, you know, you're right. I got involved in stuff. We were able to change something in my community. We were able to get them to do something. We bitch, moan, and complain, whether it be IPA, PIPA, whatever. People, in fact, complain about their emails being hacked, all their data being collected. And I'm going to tell you right now, the person that's on with me, not the one angry Jew, he resolved that. He moved his stuff to secure, and I'm assuming encrypted servers, offshore. He says, if I'm going to live in a country that spies on me, I'm going to do everything in my power to restrict their ability to do so.
Yeah, but it only works if I send mail not to the United States.
Okay. But you,
if I send mail to you, it's being monitored, isn't it?
Yeah, I did not know the extent to which your server did it. You know, there are tunneling servers that people can, in fact, sign up for. Virtual private networks.
I want to use encryption and send encryption to you, and there's plenty of good ones out there, PGP is one, then it doesn't matter where my mail is. But I will not. I was way ahead of the time. I was months ahead of the curve because I moved everything months ago prior to this whole NSA blow-up. Because I'm not going to reward the United States ISPs, because your email, if it's sitting on a server, all the FBI's got to do is say, we want to see what that email is, and the ISPs will say, sure, here it is. Why would I reward them? Screw them. My mail's in the Netherlands.
And that's what I was saying, that I was saying when people say you can't do anything. In this particular example, I say it about government. I say it about government on the local level. I understand that our government, our nation's gotten out of control, but that doesn't mean we're totally helpless. The question is, are you going to go down fighting or not? You know, I hear people yell and scream, like I say about, you know, the Patriot Act. What are they doing? Who's in charge here? Since when did the NSA get out of our control, out of the control of our elected officials, whatever, and what are we doing about it? And even if we can't do everything, the question is what are we going to do? And everyone seems to have this sense that they've done a wonderful thing in lightening someone else as to all the corruption going on, and don't do anything about it. Don't act. Don't, you know, don't hold their congressman to account. Don't. And that's the thing that drives me nuts. That was the whole compliment I was giving you about the fact that even though you've got email you send me goes through yes servers and it can be spied on, at least that which you have some control over, you've taken a step to do something to protect your privacy in those areas you can.
But I've also taken money away from United States hosting companies who are complicit. I also deleted Google accounts. I deleted Dropbox. Anything that was on that list, Snowden's list, I started deleting. And when they brought up a screen that said, why are you canceling your account, or whatever it is, I told them that if you're going to go spy on me, you can go fuck yourselves. So instead of using Dropbox, I use Woola, which is out of Switzerland.
Well, you know, certainly you can do a lot with that. I was wondering the other day, is in the big analysis, if push come to shove, is the stuff safe? If the U.S. government starts to leverage and put pressure on these countries, I know they tried to put pressure on the Swiss banks for accounts and stuff. I recall that. I don't know if that in fact is true. But maybe you know more about that. 248, you're on Blog Talk Radio with Vernon.
Hey, this is Ed from Detroit checking in.
Hi, Ed.
Hey, quick question for you guys, not about the Zimmerman trial itself, but what I wanted to ask you guys real quick. I know I'm catching you at the end of the show, but I was just watching some news clips on the internet and that, and Al Sharpton's already come out and saying he's going to get together and pursue civil rights charges, and I don't see any civil rights issues really at stake with this whole incident with the Zimmerman trial, and I just wanted to know if you guys feel there is, and then if I can get your guys' comments on that.
Well, you know,
I didn't think so either.
Well, I have a good link. Let me pull it up and try. Are you in the chat room, Ed?
Yeah, as a guest number here, guest 80.
That's okay. If I post a link for you, you can get it, right?
Yep. Yep.
Okay, because it is a link to a site some attorneys that, that followed the case quite intently, and one of they made some comments on that that. And what you want to do is you want to start this thing. I've got it on page 4. You can work your way back. You look in the archives and go under.
Okay.
You know, they have a list of their archives or hashtags it might be under. But what they said is that although the FBI had thoroughly explored this thing, no charges had been made. And so the implication was there are no civil rights violations, but it could be very much like the Rodney King thing, is that the federal government could have waited till the trial played out, and instead of moving in right away, might have been waiting for the jury to spring something on us. But I know nothing specific.
It's a good article here. I just clicked the link, and I thank you for it. And just my quick thing is I just was going to say that to me. I'm not really passionate one way or the other. It's a whole sad situation, but to me, it's a state charge, whether it's manslaughter, murder, it's a state case. I just don't see a civil rights thing out of it. I think people are just angry on their emotions, especially within the black community, like the Al Sharpins and the Louis Farrakhan. But I wanted to hear from you guys what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, I don't know about that. There again, when it comes to the federal government, there's no government or power or authority anyway. There's no telling what they will do to expand their power and how they will redefine things to make it up. I mean, I don't put anything past the government in terms of and you can when it comes to a lawsuit, you can write up almost anything.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I don't know if there'll be a federal indictment on this thing or not for, violation of civil rights. I posted the link in case you need to get there. It's called legalinsurrection.com. And let me go to the tags here. I just sent this out. If you give me 30 seconds here while I'm talking, I can find you the link because someone else asked about that. This something similar today. And I directed them to this page because there was tons of information as they followed the trial from beginning to end, and they made their legal analysis. And people are certainly entitled to agree with it or not, and people are entitled to judge and say, well, can't trust those, those bunch of rotten lawyers. What do they know? Lawyers aren't always thought of very well at this particular point in time. I thought that they covered a lot of things that I thought were fairly interesting, and did a pretty good job of it, and certainly gave a perspective. But their feeling at the time was that this thing has been researched from beginning to end, and the federal government has in fact tried. Here it is. I found it's under legal insurrection. I'll put it in the chat room here. legalinsurrection.com/tag/George-Zimmerman-trial/page/4/ And it's going in the chat room right now. So, even though you're in as a guest, you can look that thing up and have access to it.
Well, hey, thanks, guys. Enjoy the show.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Just put it in there. Legal Insurrection.
Okay,
I see it. And go there. I also put, if you're interested, there are people that had not read the judge's instructions in terms of what the jury was faced with in order to come up with a verdict. I got a copy of those, too, which I think was pretty fascinating. It was on an ABC page. I think that Legal Insurrection has it as well, but I'll put the other one in here for ease of access, as they say. An informed public is maybe a more rational public. Who knows? Let's see. We got another one on here. Let's see who I've got. 111, you're on Blog Talk Radio with Vernon, Ed, and Not the One Angry Jew.
Yeah, time for hamburgers.
time for a hamburger, eh? Okay, folks, if you want to get in here, I will go into overtime a little bit as I do every week. It is now, I got 2 minutes and 26 seconds, so I'm trying to give you a little bit more of a heads up. You know, we were talking about, as I said, Ed just asked about the Zimmerman case and whether I thought that there was going to be a federal civil rights violation charges brought against George Zimmerman. That certainly is possible. They haven't brought them yet. We shall see what happens because that is certainly a possibility. And when that in fact comes out, then that will be a whole nother issue. And maybe people will be happy with the verdict. Maybe people won't.
Who cares if they're happy with it?
Well, 6-6-1. That's an interesting question. You know, I wonder how long it's going to hang around. People are unhappy. 6-6-1.
Hi, Vern. Hi, Vern. It's Kat.
Hi,
it's Kat. 90
seconds, folks. Just last call for not alcohol. Last call to call in and go into overtime. Can you hear better now, Kat?
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you loud and clear. As they would say in the military, Lima Charlie on this end, no problem whatsoever.
Well, I think that you should see this movie called A Cabin in the Woods.
Is it a
I'm
new
gonna
movie?
Click.
I'm gonna...
I don't think so. It's a couple years old, maybe, but it's really good. I actually don't like slasher movies, but this one, it's got a twist on it. I don't want to tell you the details, but you should see it. Everybody should see it.
Well, it looks like it was a 2012 movie. It says a satirical American horror film directed and written by Drew Goddard and co-written and produced by Joss Whedon. And for all of you that aren't in here, you got 10 seconds and we're going into overtime.
Well, slasher movies are my least favorite movie. My husband talked me into.
So let me ask you, why should we watch it since slasher movies are not your favorite? I have watched slasher movies, and you know, I remember way back in the beginning when Exorcist came out, and by the time I went to see it, I think that people were pretty much prepared. I think the first people that walked in were totally caught off guard, and you know, everyone when I went in there was sitting on the edge of my seat. But why should people see it? What's without a spoiler?
Because it deals with how people perceive reality.
Well,
and it makes it's beyond the idea. It's a movie about people who choose the way in which they die. They're participants in their own death. Sort of like what we're doing today in America.
Elaborate on that.
Well, I would have to get into the plot, but...
No.
You know,
elaborate on sort of what we're doing today in America. You don't
we
need
to
get in the
belief.
Oh, okay.
We're having a... Okay. We're having an overlap in our... a lapse in the time that you hear me and I'm talking. It's about how people, because you've hooked into what reality is, we label things reality that are not reality. And so what really is reality, we're avoiding looking at that. And I don't want to get too metaphysical about it, but it's really a good movie, and I don't like slasher films. But that one was really good.
Yeah, the thing I'd asked is had to do with in participation in our own death. I always thought it was interesting that when Kevorkian was around, that people said that we have really a need for that. I've never understood why it was such a problem to commit suicide or off yourself. I don't really have any intention of doing it, and I think that. But if someone wants to die and take their own life, can't live. There are some people, I guess, that are handicapped, paraplegics, people that can't do anything that are probably could use some help. But I've also wondered why, if someone wants to off themselves, that's their choice. I probably shouldn't say that. But, you know, it always has amazed me that attempted suicide is prosecutable under the law. If you wanted to die, you know, and you botched it, why should you be punished? Maybe you should be given lessons or something.
Well, I didn't mean literal suicide, like participants in your own death. It's like literally you choose it consciously. On another level, we are. It's because we choose to perceive reality in different ways. You know, it just surprises me more and more, you know, at this point in my life, that people are really more than ever hooked into brand names and you know, what's in pop culture. People hate not to fit in, and the individuality is gone. This is like the anti-West we're living in today. And I think that's what the slasher movie was about, is how we live within this. You hear it all the time on BTR, people talk about living in the matrix. But
yes,
this movie isn't about a matrix, you know, like that movie The Matrix, but it's about people who go to a cabin in the woods. And I'll just tell you, it's actually they're in a reality TV show, and they don't know it.
I've seen the movie, but that jogs something in terms of being semi-aware of it, is that one of those things that you walk into a situation. I think that there's a new television series coming out this fall that actually plays off that. I think people who go out camping, they think they're in a reality show, but they think they're in a competition, but it's weird stuff happens. Haven't watched it. I can't remember the name of it right off. But you know, I say it another way, it's not to take away from the movie, is I've been saying a lot recently and I've done some shows even on the local radio station on this, is it just seems to me, the more I look around, that we're just really how played we are as a culture, people, society, and how much we believe stuff that, in my own opinion, we literally make up, and we forget that we make the stuff up. It's my opinion. It's a friend of mine last night that commented, you know, people are outraged about the verdict, and I can understand that. There again, I think the judge gave them as much latitude as they can, but I have to have a certain amount of trust in a jury. I wasn't there. I wasn't in the jury deliberation room, but I have been in them. As I've said before, when you get behind closed doors with jurors, it's amazing how you can spend whatever time you do in a trial with people. You think you know them. You might go out to lunch with them. You don't discuss the case, and you do whatever. And then when you get behind the closed doors and start to really get a feel for what they were really thinking or how they'd seen the trial the whole time, that's an experience that I can't express. And these six women were charged with looking at the evidence in the scientific world, we call the data, and saying if it was sufficient to come up with a guilty, not guilty, or innocent verdict. The judge actually gave them the option of a place on the bottom of the form to say innocent. And as I said, when they first came back, they decided on the second degree not fairly quickly, because they had deliberated into Friday night, and then they came back Saturday, and it was at 9 o'clock, and I think they did go to lunch at 9, and they went to about 4 or 5, as I recall. But they spent some time going over it, and they sent out a request for more of a description of what constituted manslaughter. And I've been not in a criminal jury trial, but in the jury trial I was in, we had questions. The judge sent it back and says, you need to sort through it. If you have a specific question, I'll tell you whether I can answer it, but I can't answer. You've got the legal definitions there. That's what you've got to sort out. You know, we can't give you any guidance in terms of how you come to your decision. And I truly believe that those women went behind that door and they struggled with it. They struggled with it. It was a hard case to come up with. I started to do that at the beginning of the show. I started to go over this piece this young lady wrote that was how they came up with they came back with a not guilty verdict. And that doesn't say they said he was innocent. They just said that they could not come up with a guilty verdict beyond a reasonable doubt. And I know people are unhappy with that. I know that that's troubling to people. I know, but what are you going to do? Is you're going to let the general public vote on it? They did a survey that I saw yesterday afternoon. I don't know how scientific it was, how focused it was, how regulated it was or anything. And it showed up on a sidebar on a pie chart. Who knows, it might have been an advertisement. But it said that 74% of those polled felt that, you know, that it was not beyond a reasonable doubt. So then what do? We take the law into our own hands. As they say, this is not over by any stretch of the imagination for Zimmerman. You know, he's going to live with this. There are people that are just not happy with this verdict. And it's been called a racist jury. The question I've asked is, if they'd come back with a guilty verdict, would people have been willing to say it was a non-racist, that was a non-racist decision. The jury wasn't racist. I think that's an important thing to ask. When you say, go ahead.
I was clearing my throat, but I did want to bring up something. One of the reasons I called in, I found this article. It's in Daily Caller. I put the link in the room, but I clicked out of the room. It's in Georgia. I'm just going to read this paragraph to you. Who is Joshua Chalew? It's spelled Chellew. The fact that you don't know his name is the whole point, but that's not your fault. Four South Cobb teenagers are in custody in connection with the beating death of a 36-year-old Mableton man on Mableton Parkway early Sunday morning. They have been accused in a beating death of Joshua Heath Chalew, 36. According to the warrant, the four teenagers are accused of starting a fight with Chalew at a Chevron gas station in the 6200 block of Mableton Parkway near Community Drive at about 1:20 a.m. Sunday. They repeatedly punched and kicked him, according to police. While attempting to escape, Chalew backed into the center five-lane highway and was pushed to the ground and knocked unconscious, the warrant states. Then they walked away from Chalew, leaving him helpless, and he was eventually hit by a car, the warrant states. A horrible, senseless murder. Why hasn't it received wider attention? Chalew is a 36-year-old white man. The four teenagers are black. So why didn't this get a lot? This happened the weekend before the 4th of July. We didn't hear anything in the news about this.
The news runs with what it thinks is going to get attention, and the news is we don't really have reported news. That's certainly true, in my opinion. It probably happened for a long time. But the same friend that used to raise his hand in the junior colleges and take the junior college professors to task used to say, you know, there is no news. You know, the news is created. There's news is reporting. We don't have reporting. Stories are created and made up. One of the things I found, and even though I know this is the kind of blindness that permeates life unless you start to look at it, it struck me one day, is that one of the things came across in the news, maybe it was the Benghazi thing. I can't remember. There's been so many things like that. And I got all hot to check it out, look up the details, and I go, wait a second. I don't think it was Benghazi, because I think they covered that pretty much in real time, but it was something that was reported as if it had just transpired, and the story was a month and a half, 2 months old. Here's another one along that line. This was a young black man, Justice for Darryl. On Thursday, July 11th, police discovered the rotting body of a 17-year-old Darryl Green, a black child from Englewood neighborhood of Chicago. Green's body was found behind a boarded-up house in the 6500 block of South Damon, face down on basement stairs. His body was so badly decomposed that originally local news reports suggested that he had died of blunt force trauma. On Friday, an autopsy showed that he'd been shot to death. Relatives, you know, but people are coming out posting, you know, it's stuff that happens. You know, it was a tragic thing. This one I started earlier tonight was five legal reasons why George Zimmerman was not found guilty. Okay, the main question on people's minds is how did a man who had already been pre-convicted by the media avoid conviction by a jury? So reasonable doubt. Five reasons why George Zimmerman was acquitted. Reasonable doubt. Perhaps the greatest way to sum up why Zimmerman escaped conviction is that there was reasonable doubt in legal terms. Reasonable doubt means that if there exists enough shreds of doubt, she says tiny shreds, I think it's got to be more than that, of doubt in the defendant's guilt, he cannot be found guilty. You can have doubts and still find someone guilty. Lack of eyewitness testimony. When your only eyewitness is dead, there isn't much to contest your story unless you're left a trail of circumstantial evidence. In the end, it was Zimmerman's word against Martin's word, and without Martin being there to attest, it became very difficult for the prosecution to make its case beyond a reasonable doubt. It also became much easier for the defense to paint Trayvon Martin as a less sympathetic character. Not saying that's right, I'm just, this gal's writing why they couldn't get beyond a reasonable doubt. Creepy ass crackers. Sympathetic personalities are the key to a good defense. That's why the defense attorneys focus so heavily on character witnesses. Remember the series finale of Seinfeld, where the four were convicted based on a parade of character witnesses? In the legal world, it's not as easy to introduce character witnesses. In fact, the evidence rules can make it almost impossible in some cases to include character evidence. But in the case of Trayvon Martin, the fact that he referred to Zimmerman as a creepy-ass cracker didn't go over well with the mainly white female jury. Maybe that's why, you know, white women are racist. I don't know. And it didn't take much for the defense to present this evidence. In fact, the prosecution witness was the very person who testified to the cracker remark when she was asked about the conversation she and Martin were having right after he was shot. Zimmerman's injuries. Zimmerman's lawyer showed evidence that he had a bloody nose, two cuts, and some lumps on his head. The photographic evidence, they told the jury, was the reason they believed that there had actually been a fight between Martin and Zimmerman. What may have been the smoking gun was a forensic expert who testified that Martin had been shot as he was leaning over Zimmerman, a position which indicated he was attacking Zimmerman. Five, bad choices versus bad intent. Another key element in the crime of manslaughter is intent. While first-degree murder carries a malicious intent, second-degree murder requires the defendant acted with depraved mind. In short, that means Zimmerman was required to have acted with disregard for human life. His attorney painted him to the jury not as a lunatic, but rather a well-intentioned citizen who made a series of bad choices, from getting out of his vehicle to engaging in a conflict with a stranger. In the wake of the verdict, there are many unhappy people indeed. You know, the other thing, too, that I've heard people say is the prosecution did a terrible job on presenting their case. There's other things that they could have presented, including Zimmerman's phone calls to the police on previous incidences that were mainly about black men to try and build a case for racial profiling. They used that those phone records for criminal profiling. You know, they're the question is that I still ask is both the prosecution and defense had some power in choosing the jury. They finally came up with a jury, and then at that particular point, you either have to say, well, the jury was ill-intentioned, which you will never know. I don't know how you prove that or not. Or they literally took their job as a responsibility to do to the best of their ability, and they might not have been happy to come back with a not guilty verdict, but that's the only thing they felt they could come back with. And there again, it's easy to judge and say what they should have come up with, but I don't know how many people followed the trial day in, day out, from beginning to end. And even if you did, what's missed is what happens in the jury room. The reports were that they, you know, that four of them, they pretty much came to the conclusion they couldn't give a second degree murder verdict, but then they struggled with manslaughter. And four of them said not guilty on that, two held out. And they asked for additional instructions. They were told that the case couldn't be more defined for them. They were told that they could ask specific questions. They got whatever they did. They asked for all of the evidence in the jury room, as juries usually did. And you either need to say, well, you know, they ignored it or not. And if people are convinced that they ignored it and they were going to come up with it, well, you know, they didn't. I don't know how you can convince them of that. You know, you're just not going to have faith in the jury system. And the other one that I brought up was this gal that got 20 years for mandatory sentencing when she could have gotten a plea bargain for shooting at her boyfriend. She said it was a warning shot, and she said it was a stand your ground, and she feared for her life. But that was an interesting case, too, because if you read it, a friend of mine that posted it, I looked it up and read it. That was interesting and unique in the following respect. As she left the house, went out to the car, had forgotten her keys in the house. So she left of her own volition. She was not followed out or chased by her boyfriend. She grabbed a gun out of the house, went back into the house to get her keys, and then she fired a shot through a wall. He was on the other side. It was at head height. She said it was a warning shot. And there were children in that other room, and under Florida law on an aggravated assault like that that involves a loaded gun and shooting a gun, the mandatory sentence was 20 years. In that particular case, from what I read in it, it was the same prosecutor that a lot of people were upset with the jury, with the prosecutors, came back vociferously and said, not at all. You know, totally different case. And it turns out in that particular case, the jury deliberated a total of 13 minutes. The jury was pretty much, you know, when a jury comes back with that kind of a verdict, with a verdict like that, a guilty verdict in 13 minutes, the evidence, as far as the jury was concerned, in from what I know about juries and in my opinion, was fairly compelling. That was not a struggle for them to decide at all. I'm just, like I say, I can't say I'm beating a dead horse here. You know, I think it's a tragedy happened there. I think that no one will, in fact, know. There is stuff all over the internet about things that came out. You know, we can all speculate. We, you know, the prosecution tried to paint Trayvon Martin is a frightened kid running from Zimmerman. I don't know how all that went over with the jury, if they really bought that one. I would think that if he was really afraid for his life, but this is just speculation, that he would have called 911 instead of called his girlfriend and chatted. But I wasn't there. That's just all the same kind of speculation. I watched and listened to some of the testimony, and I thought when I saw the prosecution or the defense questioning people on the stand, they did a better job than the prosecution. But that's not particularly unusual either. They said about the O.J. Simpson case in Los Angeles that the prosecution had overreached the case. They could have probably gotten a second-degree murder conviction on O.J. A lot of people thought that was a travesty, too, that people could find him not guilty. But premeditation is a hard thing to prove. You know, it doesn't need to be lengthy, but there again, who was there notwithstanding other things in that case and notwithstanding the jury, it's easy for you and I, all of us, to sit out here with our opinions and our points of view and how we see the case and call it. And I say a lot of times to friends, we're great prognosticators on the past and the future. Everyone's got an opinion of how it's going to turn out. And everyone knows exactly why it turned out the way it did after the fact. And everyone wants to take credit that it turned out that way because of the way they saw it. Don't know what to say.
That's true.
You know, it's they certainly didn't find him innocent because the judge gave him that option. As I said last night, the judge gave the option of going for the lowest murder charge you can get in Florida, manslaughter. He was not charged with manslaughter. You know, that's very unusual for the judge to just automatically say, well, if you can't come up with a conviction for second-degree murder, you can go for manslaughter. Rarely, you know, they didn't do that in the O.J. case. The O.J. case, the judge didn't say, if you can't find him guilty of first-degree murder, you can certainly consider manslaughter or second-degree murder. That was not an option given. So I think that the judge did everything that she could do under the law to make it as possible, as easily possible for that jury to come up with a guilty verdict within the law. And there again, it's just, I want everyone to know this. I am one of the people that will tell you over and over and over, this is speculation on my part. I don't get my information from God or a higher power. I get it from the same sources you do. I sort through stuff to the extent that I do, just like you do. And that's my assessment. I wasn't in the jury room, and I think that's a very powerful place to be, and you need to understand what it's like to be in a jury room to understand how juries come to conclusions. I think the women did it with, and I'm certainly, I know there are people who say, well, yeah, I understand, but there's hidden racism and stuff. I really think people do everything in their power to try and put those things aside. I wish that the trial had gone to trial. I wish we had a system in which everything other than the evidence could be left out. I've said this before, in this day and age, I don't think that witnesses should ever be on a stand where people can see them. I think that everything should go through a voice modulator translator so that everything gets heard in the same monotone from every witness. I don't think the defense or prosecution should be able to wander around with their theatrics. You know, I think that everything should be fairly bland paper white so that people get the data, nothing but the data. The questions can be there, and then the jury sorts it out, but we don't do it that way. We have courtrooms in which people show up, and the defense puts on their case, the prosecution puts on their case. I've had an attorney friend, I think I've said this before, he said he liked the law because the best argument won, always won. No, I don't think so at all. What wins is the best presentation. I have another trial attorney friend that was very successful, won 94% of his cases when practicing. That's a high percentage of cases. That's a pretty damn good record. And he tried over 100 cases. That's pretty damn good. He says what wins or loses a case are opening arguments. Well, in this particular case, the defense team with the knock-knock joke, that didn't go over very well, but ultimately it didn't hurt them. It's easy to sit on the sideline and bring everything that we have to the table in terms of what we believe, how we see it, how we analyze the data, how we felt about what happened, all that stuff. But when it comes down to it, we've decided to come up with a system that says that, you know, in cases of these matters, in criminal cases, you know, liberty and freedom is so important as a person that although it's easy enough to charge people, you need to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt. And in criminal cases of this nature, you have to prove it. You have to have a unanimous verdict. You know, even at 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon, when they called for additional instructions, it was split 4-2. And the outcome of 4-2 would have been very similar. What the prosecution would have been left with was they would have had a hung jury, and they would have had to decide if they wanted to go back and retry it. And then what would have people done? It gets retried again. Would people have been a whole different jury selected? Everyone goes down there. Would people have been happy with the case then? Let's say the prosecution would have gotten a guilty verdict the second time around. That would have been interesting in a very strange way. Okay, best 2 out of 3. I don't think it would have ended that way. It could have gotten appealed at that particular point. It's just a very messy case, in my opinion. Do I believe that there are racists in the United States? Absolutely. Do I believe that there are a lot of non-racists in the United States? Absolutely. Do I believe that some people get caught up in the justice system and don't get justice? Absolutely. I got caught up in the justice system and didn't get justice, Kat. It wasn't a criminal case. Someone sued me. I was improperly served. The law in the state of California says if it will serve justice to grant an extension, the court must do that. The judge entered a default judgment against me. He did not, you know, he rejected or he didn't even get my request for a postponement of the date because I got it. I was supposed to have 10 days notice. I didn't. The judge determines what to do on that is the judge that called the thing. I went in. He didn't listen to the case. See, if you get a default, for those of you that don't understand the law, is if someone enters a default judgment against you, you don't get to argue the case. No matter what the reason, the judge has to set aside the default and open it back up. And since he entered a default against me because I hadn't showed up, even though I'd gotten my appropriate papers into the court requesting, you know, a continuance, a new trial date, I guess the court didn't get that to the judge. I wasn't there. He entered a default against me. I had to file a motion then to set aside the default, which I did. Motion denied. Means that they're not going to be able to hear the case. I got to appeal it to Superior Court. The judge waited till the courtroom entered, and she denied it again. So I had a judgment entered against me by someone filed, and it was on a wrong account and everything that I never got to argue. I thought it was a miscarriage of justice. That's just the way it is. It's a long time ago. So, you know, justice is people get caught up in the justice. People get wrongly convicted. We've seen that. People do long periods of time, get released because of DNA evidence. It's kind of like they say about democracy. You know, it's a terrible system of government, but it's the representative democracy we have is terrible as it is better than anything else, any other alternative out there, although a bunch of people would disagree with you. Same thing with the legal system. I don't know. You want people to take it back in their own hands on the streets? I don't know. You know, people might do that. Yeah, when we start to take the law in their own hands, and I'm not saying the law is perfect, and I'm not saying that the justice is always served. It depends on how you define justice. Do I think that these ladies tried to do their best? Yeah. Do I think that people are unhappy with the verdict? Yeah. Did I think that Zimmerman would get convicted of manslaughter when the judge allowed that? Yeah, I actually did. I was surprised.
I did too. I thought he was going to get convicted of manslaughter.
Yeah, but he didn't. I was surprised when the verdict came back. And the thing that surprised me a lot, I've said this over and over, is what, this claim of the jury being racist. I find, if it had all been white men, I could have understand that kind of claim a little bit better. You know, that, well, you know, it's all white jury, they're prejudiced towards Zimmerman and stuff. But the fact it was all women, and people, a lot of people were upset with that choice in the beginning. You can't make people happy. It's like Solomon and the baby. Except in the Solomon baby case, as if it had turned out that neither of the women would have budged, and Solomon hacked the baby in half, and people would be complaining about that, and he'd say, listen, you know, you couldn't come up with a decision. That's how I said I was going to resolve it. That's what happened. We don't care. I don't know. It's a terrible tragedy. It's loss, senseless loss of life. But unless someone has a crystal ball and can go there, you know, what they know is what they believe. And when it comes to beliefs, and what happened, if you weren't there, you don't know. You can make all the arguments you want, as cogent as you want, as sharp as you want, as articulate as you want, in my opinion. And in the ultimate analysis, it's like all the politicians that go on talk shows say, well, those are just hypotheticals. You've heard that before. I don't want to answer that. You know, that's a hypothetical. That's a well.
Yeah.
You know, well, hypothetically, if it was this way, I don't have mind hypotheticals. Yeah, if it was all that way, this is in fact what coulda, woulda, may have happened, and that's the hypothetical. The reality is it wasn't. I say terrible. I don't. So, I go ahead.
Just so many people couldn't grasp that it didn't matter what happened previous to the confrontation. People just could not understand that it didn't matter about George Zimmerman getting out of his truck. It didn't matter that where, you know, what transpired before the confrontation. What mattered was the confrontation and what happened after that point. And you just can't get it through their heads.
Yeah, well, you know, under the law, that's the way it is. And people would say that's unjust. You know, Zimmerman was licensed to carry that gun. It also turns out there's a lot of people probably going to be upset about this, but under Florida law, apparently being found not guilty, you know, he has a right to get his gun back and carry it until someone removes that privilege from him. That's really going to, you know, it's like I say, I think it was a terrible tragedy, a terrible mistake. I think it was totally under avoidable on both accounts. And clearly, as has been brought up, is Trayvon Martin shouldn't have had to run. You're absolutely right. He shouldn't have had to run. You know, I don't know. The simulation was speculation in terms of who hit who and who hit what. The one juror, the one witness, from his description, said that what he saw was someone on top of Zimmerman, you know, punching him mixed martial arts style. In one of the things that I read, he was the only one that said they saw anything about what happened there. You know, the actual officer in charge of the investigation on the challenges that I saw of him, I heard a lot of people talking about Zimmerman lying, but what the officer in charge of the investigations with multiple interrogations and questioning says, well, you know, he got little facts right, wrong, and they, you know, differed, but nothing substantive from all my years having done this, especially when I interrogated him at midnight and I had this piece of information, this, everything seemed to add up. And go ahead.
No, I had to cough. I'm sorry, Vern.
So, you know,
I was just going to say it is a tragedy. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, during all this, I keep thinking about Trayvon Martin's mother. I think about her, and would she, even if George Zimmerman had been found guilty, she's not going to have any peace. I'm not saying that was a reason for him not to be found guilty, but I just can't imagine losing a son. And what I understand, that was her only child, so... You know, she's got to find a reason to go on and what to live for at this point.
Yeah, I mean, that's a terrible loss for a mother. You know, it's a terrible loss for a mother and father and parents of any child that gets killed. We have a lot of gang shootings. Well, not as many as other places, but in Salinas, you know, there, a lot of people lose their kids here. They get shot due to gang violence. Terrible things. And that's something that a parent, you know, listen, a parent is going to suffer if there's an accidental shooting in the house of, you know, of there recently was a shooting. It was one of the ones that made everyone go nuts. And I can't remember where it was, but a police officer was having a barbecue and stuff, and he kept all his guns and everything locked up, and he was showing his friend a new weapon or something he had, and it was on the bed, and the little 3 or 4 year old girl wandered in. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen kids. I mean, they're low, they're hard to see out of sight if you're not paying attention to them every moment. And the little girl wound up picking up the gun. It was a split second, and wound up shooting her mother dead. Terrible tragedy. I wonder, that kid's probably going to feel really bad about that when they grow up and find out they killed their own mother. I was part of a volunteer dive team back in 1967. Yeah, I was working in a gas station. That was right before I went in the Army. My boss came in. He knew I scuba dived. He says, "You want to go diving?" I said, "You kidding?" He says, what's going on?" He says, "Well, a little kid disappeared up at Lake Hemet, Southern California. Parents haven't seen him in a couple of days. We're going to do a volunteer dive to see if maybe we can find his body in the lake or the reservoir." And so I grabbed my dive gear. We went up there. I was with the guy that found him, you know, floating off the bottom, little 3-year-old kid. The guy that was next to me, we pulled him in, had a son that age. It really shook him up. The news media, you know, started asking questions. We broke the surface. I told him, "Oh, get fucked. Fuck you, you know, leave him alone." Those are terrible tragedies. You know, I lived in a mortuary for over a year. I've seen, you know, young people die. It's a tragedy. It's hard on it's terrible on the parents. I mean, it's not a justification for anything. And I feel sorry for Trayvon Martin's mother and father. I think it's a terrible tragedy. There are innocent people in Oakland. There are businesses that are being having rocks thrown through their window and painted up there as people in fact riot. They are victims, if you will, of a terrible situation. It spreads out and it's affected the country.
Yeah. What I don't understand is why this case? Why are so many people upset over this case? I mean, I know the answers to this. It's just that there are so many other cases also. But this one, the president, you know, stepped in and said he made the nation identify with this child. And just been so much chaos, a lot of hatred, and media making money off of it. It's disgusting. I refuse to watch cases like this. Like, I didn't watch the Casey Anthony case. I thought that was pretty disgusting. And I think Nancy Grace is one of my least favorite people on television. Can't stand to watch her.
you know, that was an interesting, that was, I'd forgotten about that case, but that was an interesting case where people clearly could not see how they could come up with a not guilty verdict on her. Everyone was sure she was going to, you know, be found guilty and cooked, right?
Oh, yeah.
Everyone was sure that one was in the bag. And to what do people attribute that verdict of not guilty? What kind of prejudices were involved in that one?
I don't remember. I don't remember why they found her not guilty.
Well, you know, the point is this is the hard thing to come to grips with in the law, and I know it makes it seem like it's bias, and the law is bias in many respects. I think, and the law tries to handle things objectively as we can. I don't think that always works, and it always turns out that way. And it's like I say, just to say. The jury was racist, or it was a racist decision. It seems to me you've got to say that, you know, that women, those women, that's certainly an assertion. I'm willing to accept that, but you got to do one or two things from my perspective, and it's only mine. If you're going to do it in an objective fashion, if you're going to do it in a subjective fashion. That way, I accept that. I accept that as your evidence for saying the jury was racist, that you base it on a subjective emotions. I can't argue with that. I mean, I can't say it's you feel the way you do. We all have the feelings that we do. Okay. But from an objective standpoint, I think that, you know, really needs to be examined. If someone's going to say that objectively, not passionately, then you need to come up and say why you believe that the women were racist, and did it have to do with the verdict. And then I ask, is if the verdict had been the other way, if it had been guilty, would you have still said it was a racist jury?
Well, no, they wouldn't be saying that. Of course they wouldn't be saying it, that they were racist if they got the verdict they wanted. But the point is,
if you're going to be intellectually honest and say that the jury was racist, you have to say upon what evidence do you base that. And it seems to me the only evidence at this point happens to be based on the verdict they gave, because most people don't know who the jury was. I read you their backgrounds last night. I don't know anyone that was in the jury room, because no one's in the jury room except the jury.
The comeback to that is, well, we live in a racist country, so of course they expected this.
Okay.
So
stick with me on this. Stick with me on this, Kat. This is very important. We live on upon what do you base that assertion? I live in Santa Cruz, California. I don't see racism. Not certainly the nature you're talking. I'm not saying racism doesn't exist, and I'm not saying there aren't racist people. But if someone's going to make the assertion, I want to know upon what they base that. You've got to start. I started off the show with this, by the way, and maybe I need to do a whole show. It's worth doing a whole show on. I started to collect some notes, because this is an important thing. You know, Jackie posted a great thing by Malcolm X that I loved it. I went looking for it on her site. I'd like to play it again. I think it's powerful, because what he says. He says some very powerful things. He talks about what the black community they need to resolve their own issues among themselves. I'm paraphrasing this now, but he goes on to say, until blacks and whites can sit down and talk openly, and he says without hurting each other's feelings, I don't know that I think it's better if feelings aren't hurt, because I think that tends to keep dialogue open more. But I think that there are certain people that can have their feelings hurt, hold on to those hurt feelings, and still have legitimate discussions and openly discuss their issues. And you know, just because I don't see that as an important issue, I'm saying this hypothetically, doesn't mean that it's not important to you or that you don't see it that way. You could be, we can be dismissive all we want about, I don't get it. You know, how could you possibly see that way? Because you do. And it's important for the person on that end to understand that. But until we can get to that point and get stuff out on the table, there'll be this seething underground stuff. And this suspicion, what it all boils down to ultimately, in my opinion, is fear, trust. It's plagued humankind since the beginning of time. And I don't know if humans will ever advance to that point. I really don't. But to say it's a racist nation, okay, you know, the one, I'll give you some of the arguments, you know them. They'll go back and forth. And what people say here, I'm going to tell you, this is part of the problem. People say, well, I've heard that one before. Well, I've heard that one before is not an answer to the question. So the one that people would put out there right now and say to you, well, if it was such a racist nation, how come Barack Obama was voted in twice? And then depending on who you split that one with, well, people say, well, he's not really black. It was really a black man. They wouldn't vote. Whatever.
Right.
And it will go.
You're right. I mean, but what I was saying, what I meant was, I've been listening to people talk, especially on BTR, and they're coming up with this thing that the jury is racist, that, you know, black people can't get justice. And I hear Jackie, you know, saying, I've given up. There's no justice for a black person in the court system. Well, it really disheartens me to hear her say that. And she has every right to believe that, and I understand why she does. But it's still very disheartening to me as a child of the 60s who believed that all this stuff would be straightened out by now in America. And it's worse than ever, Vern. It just seems like we're going downhill with this racism.
No, but Kat, you may be right. I don't know. I think that... Here's part of the problem for me is I think it is better than it was in the 60s. We've come a long ways, and we still got a long ways to go. And I think what happens is it clouds the water is not recognizing whatever progress has been made and moving on from there. Now, that being said, what I have to tell you very clearly about me is I've never lived in the South. And I think that the South has a totally, from people I've heard talk about, there's a totally different mindset down there than there is out here in California. Now, am I saying that there's not race in California? There are certain places that are more racist than others, I'm sure. Go ahead.
Well, I did grow up in the South, and I have been to the New England, and believe me, I encountered racism in New England like I didn't grow up with. Not just racism, but just this clannish attitude they have up there about, even like Catholics, they differentiate between Spanish Catholics and Irish Catholics and just all this division up there. I mean, it's like back in the 50s in my mind. Now, that's just in a community type situation. But it seems like, you know, schools were integrated when I was in seventh grade, and it was fine. We knew each other anyway. We just got to go to school together at that point. And it just didn't seem, then we could talk and we could, you know, we could compete against each other in sports and, you know, debate club, and we're in plays together and things. I mean, it just didn't seem to be this hostility. Maybe I grew up in, you know, like this bubble or whatever, but and we have made progress as far as blacks being able, having access to education and employment and healthcare and things like that. but it's just this anger. It's not just so much about those things you can measure. It's an attitude. I don't know if it's just the way the education system is set up now, that those who, you know, are poor, they don't have as much access to quality education. But today, we didn't have Al Sharptons. We didn't have, the leaders, the civil rights leaders that we had were really trying to make a difference. And today, it's
we have the Sharptons, but the Martin Luther King and all the people that marched during that era encountered severe racism in the South, you know, and the dogs and the hoses and all that.
I'm not denying that happened. Yeah, I didn't grow up in the Deep South. I grew up in Virginia. That was very brutal. That was horrible. That was horrible. They had to, but it took real quality leaders to stand up to, you know, what was his name, Bull Connor?
Yeah.
And people like him, yeah. And it took a lot of people from the North to go down there and shame those people into acting, you know, to change. Well, they didn't really change, but it took a president, and it took a president dying, JFK, to get another president, LBJ, who really, you know, JFK had this character flaw. I mean, LBJ had a character flaw. He needed to be liked. He wanted to be loved, and he really wanted to pass that civil rights legislation. But today, I don't think that people realize what a significant and life-changing thing it was in our country for that civil rights legislation to be signed and what it meant at that time.
Yeah, you know, clearly, it's like men trying to talk about, very frankly, you know, I'm a man, so I will never, ever, 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 till my dying day, and my days are probably more numbered than yours because I'm probably a little older, never be able to appreciate what having a period is like, what it's like to birth a child or something like that. I can intellectually grapple with that. And so to say that I understand in many of these areas is absolute nonsense. I don't even pretend to. All I can tell you is that I can bring to the party is my understanding to the extent I'm able to. You understand what I'm saying? By the same token, I hear a lot of women of the age, of course, you know, talk about discrimination about women and stuff. And one of the places that men have typically been whores in the world is to their jobs. I mean, I watch a lot of women say, you know, how badly they're treated in the workforce. And I chuckle because what I think a lot of women are experiencing as they get into the workforce and as we go on into a society and a world where men and women are equally qualified and allowed to work, they're experiencing things that men have been experiencing for years. You know, I think that women are their own worst enemy in many cases, but all those, there are distinctions, things we will never totally be able to understand, but to the extent someone's willing to sit down with us and have a discussion, you know, I know people that would tell you, we've had it on Blog Talk Radio, there are shows about white guilt, this, that, whatever, not the one angry Jews hammered me on this, and I know that people say, you know, what do you have to be upset about, you know, you've had all the good stuff. Well, whether it's true or not, the fact is people feel the way they do about their life, whether they in fact feel that they're being discriminated against because they're white or not. Listen, perception is reality. That's the whole thing. That's part of the thing about your movie, The Cabin. And what people don't understand, it seems to me, is to the extent that we don't understand that we generate and create our reality in the way we see things in many respects, and then we're stuck with what we have. There are theories coming out right now. I've talked about this. This gets on a whole different tangent and stuff. One's called the holographic paradigm. There are people right now speculating that the way we perceive the world is not a function of seeing something out there that we respond to as we look out and take it in, but something we project out there from within ourselves that's a composite of all our sensories, perceptions being impinged upon. That's a very different way of looking at the world. When you understand, if you start to even perceive or think for a second, we might get cut off here anytime I'm watching the magic clock, that really what I see is the world out there really is not how it is, but something I project from me out there based on everything I'm made up of. That takes on totally different overtones.
Yeah, I mean, as a person who, dabbles in painting and loves art, I know exactly, how I experience that is that I'm the happiest when I don't try to project my views out there and who I am out there, but I rather let what's around me become my reality. Do you understand what I mean? It's like I can look what's inside myself and it's when I'm more peaceful. It's when I can be more creative. But when I am bombarded by so much information and technology, it's I cannot get in a creative mindset. Does that make sense?
No, it absolutely does. That's why people like peace, still, and silence. That's why one of my Facebook friends, if you will, a fine, interesting young man, has really gotten deeply into these samadhi tank floats. Have you ever floated in a sensory deprivation tank?
I have a friend who has one.
Oh,
but
you
I haven't.
Try. No. Ask him if he'll let you do a float. Start off 15 minutes, maybe an hour. A lot of people can't handle it for a whole, you know, long time to begin with. It gets very strange when you're isolated from any external sounds. There's absolutely no light. The water temperature that's running.